You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Welcome to Aryan Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 29th of October, 2018, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAryan.com. And I'm very pleased to say that we've got Max Musson back from Western Spring today to join us. Max, how are you doing today?
I'm very well indeed. Yes, it's I'm enjoying life at the moment, keeping myself busy, and looking forward to our chat this afternoon.
Yeah, so it's a beautiful autumnal day out there. I hear you've been out and about, Max. I hear you went to this meeting last weekend. Unfortunately, I was unable to make it myself. A revisionist history meeting with Professor Forison, and lots of things have gone on since then. Did you want to talk a little bit about that? Let our listeners know what went on there. I'm sure most have probably heard that Professor Forison passed away the day after, but what sort of went on before then, and how the meeting actually got shut down, I believe, was a first. So do you want to tell us a little bit about that? What went on there, and how the meeting went? As much of it that did actually go on, I do believe it went on for about 2 hours before it was stopped. Is that right?
Yeah, it was a very interesting meeting, actually, and a number of quite interesting issues came up. I learned about the meeting quite some time in advance of it taking place, and the way that it was billed to me was that Professor Forison is approaching his 90th birthday and was keen to make one last speech before effectively retiring from public life. I think he found that felt that he had reached a point where his health was deteriorating to the point where he didn't feel that he could continue to campaign for historical revisionism any further, and what he wanted was to have one last event here in the UK where he could deliver a speech about his life's work and effectively use that as a swan song before, as I say, bowing out of public life. And and that's pretty much what the whole event was. Two other speakers that spoke on at the same time, but it was mainly all about Professor Forison. And the meeting had been arranged with a high degree of secrecy because we knew that there would be people, our political enemies, who would want to disrupt what was taking place and prevent Professor Forison from speaking. And in fact, there was some fear that the authorities would take steps to prevent Professor Forison from being able to come into the country even. So, as I say, there was this high degree of secrecy. The meeting was a private meeting booked at a hotel in Shepperton, and I'd had a little bit of involvement with with Heritage and Destiny, who were the organisers of the meeting. I didn't make a massive contribution, as I say, I had a little bit of involvement, and I think a great deal of credit goes to Heritage and Destiny and to Peter Rushton, Michelle Renouf and Richard Edmonds, who were very instrumental in making sure this meeting could take place. The meeting started at around about midday. We gathered at the hotel. It was a very convivial reception there with a buffet, and then we went through to the meeting room in order to listen to the speeches. And we had an introductory speaker. Then Professor Forison stood up to speak, and he effectively spoke about his life's work and the fact that he had always found that there were issues relating to the traditional Holocaust narrative that didn't seem to make sense to him, that didn't seem to chime with the evidence that was available. And he spoke about the various episodes during his career where he had challenged the accepted Holocaust narrative, spoke about the ways in which the authorities had tried to clamp down on his work, etc. And he delivered his speech in fine fashion. So I think he did actually achieve everything he wanted to achieve. You know, he had an audience of people who had come to hear him speak. It was at a quite a prestigious location. There was a goodly number of people there from all over the UK, but also from other countries as well. People had come to listen to what he had to say. And as I say, he delivered his speech in fine fashion, so it was great. The meeting started to deviate from what had been planned, however, when just shortly before the end of Professor Furison's speech, Peter Rushton, who had been instrumental in organising the meeting, was called away to speak to the hotel staff. And he then came back and told us that the hotel staff had received some phone calls from people claiming to be Antifa, who were making all sorts of blood-curdling threats to the hotel and the hotel staff if they didn't shut the meeting down immediately. According to Peter Rushton, the hotel staff had the words that were used were that there would be words to the effect that there would be crystal meth fueled crackheads who would be attacking the hotel and its staff in large numbers, something of that sort. But that these were the threats that were being made, and so obviously the hotel staff took the threats quite seriously. They appeared to recognise that the threat from Antifa could be a potentially genuine threat because of things that had happened in the past, presumably, and they asked us if we would close the meeting down. Unfortunately, we'd already paid for the meeting hall, Peter Rushton wasn't of a mind to have let the meeting stop. He was going to be speaking last at the meeting, and so he told the hotel staff that because we weren't doing anything wrong, there was nothing illegal taking place, because of the fact that he didn't believe that the threats against the hotel were actually credible, because, you know, disgusting and vile though Antifa are, I don't think even they could muster any appreciable number of crystal meth fueled crackheads to come and attack the hotel staff. I think that was just all rhetoric, and so he opted to continue with his speech. And so he started, and probably about 10 minutes into his speech, the hotel manager came through and interrupted the meeting again and wanted to shut the meeting down. And again, Peter refused and said that no, it was his right to continue for them to fulfill their part of the contract that he had with them, basically, which was that we would have the meeting room for the rest of the afternoon. And so he carried on, and the hotel staff then became very insistent and then started to do some silly things, in my view, in order to try and stop Peter from being able to speak. They turned on the fire alarms, they went away and got ghetto blasters, and they were playing rock music through the ghetto blasters and disco music in an attempt to disrupt Peter. But Peter was determined that he was going to carry on speaking, and it was actually a tour de force. I mean, Peter was very, very impressive in the fact that he was able to deliver what was a very detailed speech, detailing lots of evidence, etc., and giving the references for where that information had come from, and to continue to put forward his argument in a logical and forceful and very entertaining way, I should say. And those of us at the meeting, we felt that we should support him, and so we all sat around him in a tight cluster. We moved all the tables out of the way, and we moved our chairs closer, and we all sat around him, and it was a really unique experience in that, despite the fact that fire alarms were going, despite the fact there was all this music belting out of these ghetto blasters, We could actually all hear what Peter Rushton was saying because we were sitting so close to him, and he was speaking so loudly, actually. I mean, it was amazing. He was able to, as I say, speak as loudly as that and as cogently as that for as long as he did. But he actually delivered the whole of his speech. And at the end of it, the meeting finished in the way that we'd all planned. We all got up and left the hotel in a very orderly fashion. A number of people went and got themselves drinks from the bar, etc. And we all spilled out into the the courtyard in front of the hotel and stood around and and discussed what had taken place. And the spirits of the people that had attended the meeting were quite high. You know, we weren't. We didn't feel that, that our enemies had won. We felt that we had persisted, and particularly with Peter Rushton's absolutely tremendous effort, we had been able to hold the entire meeting that we wanted to. Professor Furison was in good spirits because he had, because the meeting had gone ahead and we had held the meeting the way that had been planned, despite the sort of disruption. As it turned out, no Antifa turned up whatsoever, although it was interesting that a photograph appeared in the Twitter feed for Hope Not Hate, what must have been minutes after the phone calls had started arriving at the hotel. And so we're left with two options, really, in considering how, you know, what had happened and who it was that had actually initiated the problem with the hotel management, because either we have to believe that somebody from Antifa had independently of Hope Not Hate followed somebody who had attended the meeting and had therefore discovered the location of the meeting as a result of doing that, and that at the same time and unbeknown to them, somebody from Hope Not Hate had followed somebody else to the meeting and had stood outside and photographed the outside of the hotel and then sent that, sort of relayed that photograph back so that it could be posted on Hope Not Hate's Twitter feed. Or we have to accept that there's quite a high likelihood that the person who made the threatening phone calls to the hotel staff was also the same person who sent the photograph back to Hope Not Hate and could either have been Antifa or could have been an employee of Hope Not Hate, and so it raises the prospect, really, of Hope Not Hate becoming involved in threats of that sort to a venue and to the hotel staff. And it would be quite a serious thing if it was proven, if we could prove that in fact it was somebody from Hope Not Hate who had made those threatening phone calls, because the definition of terrorism is the use or the threat of the use of violence for political purposes. And so if somebody is telephoning a hotel and they're making threats of violence, and their motive for making those threats of violence is to have a political impact, i.e. to deny freedom of speech to people that they regard as their political enemies, then that is, strictly speaking, that is terrorism. And I think that it would be not beyond the realms of possibility that anti-terrorist police might want to actually investigate who it was that made those threats to the hotel, and whether or not the person that made the threats to the hotel were actually genuinely Antifa people, independent of Hope Not Hate, or whether they were people who were either employed directly by Hope Not Hate or who work in association with Hope Not Hate. And I think that would be a very interesting line of investigation, and it would be very interesting to see what came out of a serious investigation on the part of the anti-terrorist police. But you know, we're living in Britain in the early 2000s, and the possibility that anti-terrorist police would actually want to take that line of investigation is fairly remote. It's very deplorable that is, you know, that it is remote, it would only be fair-handed if the police were to police the sort of violent left as tightly as they appear to want to police the violent right.
Well, you know, obviously there was some collaboration that was going on there, but hope not hate. They appear to think that they are above the law anyway. And if you just look at their actions recently, you've got a proscribed organisation that's prescribed as being a terrorist organisation, and they pay somebody to be a part of that organisation and record what's going on and report back to them, as if Hope Not Hate are the secret police, as if they're MI5. Well, they're not. They're supposed to just be a charity. And yet, by actually doing that, by encouraging somebody to be a part of a prescribed organisation, what they're saying is that they are above the law. In actual fact, they had to get special dispensation so that their mole, that was a part of the alleged prescribed organisation, wasn't actually charged with that. And they had no permission from the police to be doing that. It was all retroactive. The protection that was given to their mole was retroactive. So Hope Not Hate had been acting above the law for quite some time up until that point. And just by doing that, they were putting other people's lives at risk. Other people's lives were threatened because it was quite obvious, I believe, to the people involved that there was a mole somewhere. So they were looking for a mole. And they could quite conceivably have gone after the wrong person. So Hope Not Hate were putting other people's lives at risk. They quite clearly think that they are above the law. And it really wouldn't surprise me if they were to be doing something like this, if they were to be phoning up the hotel, making threats. I find that entirely credible that they would do something like that, because they really do think that they can get away with doing just about anything. I mean, one question that I've got about this, Max, was Professor Forreson speaking in French, or was he actually speaking in English during his speech?
I know he was speaking English. One of the interesting things about Professor Forreson is that he was actually born in Shepparton, which is why he wanted to make his final swan song speech in Shepparton. He was born in Shepparton, although his parents moved to France whilst he was still very young, and so he'd grown up in France, but could speak very good English.
No, that interested me, because I think I've seen his stuff before, but it's always just been there in French. And then he left after this meeting, and within 24 hours, apparently he died of a heart attack, as I'm sure most of our listeners are aware. Do you think this excitement that may have contributed to his heart attack in any way at all? Did he seem distressed when all this loud music was playing and the fire alarms were being set off? How did he seem when that was going on?
No, he didn't seem distressed. He seemed to be very sort of a very game person who was prepared to concur with Peter Rushton that the meeting should go on. He had a meal with Peter Rushton and I think Michelle Renew from Richard Edmonds after the event, at which Peter Rushton said he appeared to be very calm and composed. So I don't think that the commotion at the meeting that had any contributory factor. I think that what we've seen here is an example of somebody who has achieved their life's work. And there are a number of times throughout my life I've known of people who have who've become quite elderly, who have sensed that they've got some underlying health issue, and that underlying health issue is likely to sort of bring their life to a close fairly shortly, and so they then they psychologically look around for something to cling on to live for, so that they can then feel their life is ending on a high note. And so, you know, I've known of instances where somebody has been a grandparent, and they've one of their grandchildren is expecting a baby, and they kind of set as their target in life that they want to live long enough so that their grandchild is born, and so that they can die as a great grandparent, and so they can see that great grandchild before they go. And and this happens quite a lot. And I think in Professor Furison's case, he had decided that his underlying health condition was deteriorating, and that was the reason why he didn't feel able to continue with his life's work. And so he had decided that he wanted to have this one last swan song meeting here in the UK, and that having achieved that, having achieved his goal, perhaps subconsciously he then his body then decided that that was the time to call a close, and he didn't die in sort of circumstances where it caused tremendous distress tremendous distress. He waited until he had gone all the way back to his home in Vichy in France. And it was once he had crossed the threshold of his house and he was in the hallway of his house that the heart attack struck, and he died at that point. And that was the point where he had, as I say, he delivered this one last swan song speech, returned successfully home, unharmed from the meeting, and with this tremendous sense of achievement, and had nothing else left to live for, basically. And I think that's why, you know, he died at that point. We can feel quite good for him that he did manage to achieve that, and that he did go out at a high point in his career rather than just quietly dwindling away as a result of declining health.
Definitely. Well, one other thing that strikes me about this, if you're actually running a hotel, then you are responsible for the safety of your guests. And the guests were obviously Peter Rushton, Professor Forreson, and all the people that had booked that hall for a meeting. If there is a threat to the safety of the guests, it's up to the hotel owners to protect them. It's up to the hotel owners to call the police if they think there is a credible threat. Did the hotel owners call the police? It seems very strange to me that the hotel owners just suddenly started essentially attacking the guests and telling the guests that they must leave when the hotel has just been told, well, that there's going to be a gang of Antifa that are going to be descending upon the hotel. It seems very strange to me, because if it had been any other group of people, say somebody had phoned up and said, you've got a load of Negroes in your hotel, we've got a load of Ku Klux Klan Nazis outside, and they're going to attack all these Negroes in your hotel. It would seem very strange to me if the hotel owners were then to say, come on, Negroes, you've got to get out. There's a load of KKK out there that are going to attack you. I mean, obviously, that's just, an example there. But when it's round the other way, it doesn't seem to matter, does it? If there's a threat to the guest's health, what are the hotel owners doing? Trying to remove you all and send you out there? Did they call the police?
It appears that they didn't call the police. I think that once they had received those telephone calls and they'd spoken to Peter Rushton and they had established that the meeting was a meeting of the type that it was, and from their perspective, they probably wouldn't have welcomed the prospect of having a controversial meeting at their hotel of people who were in their books Holocaust deniers, and so probably the senior management of the hotel, who perhaps weren't even on the premises, had conveyed to the hotel management and hotel staff that they had to shut the meeting down. And I think I wouldn't like to go so far as to say that the hotel staff were sort of complicit or negligent or anything of this sort. They were just, in my view, they were just following their orders. That the hotel owners probably felt that they'd got their money for the bookings, and so if the bookings were terminated, that that they wouldn't have been out of pocket, and that they just didn't really want controversy. And it was a shame, though, that the hotel staff were rather childish in terms of the things that they use, because I think Peter Rushton was quite within his rights, and the rest of us were quite within our rights to stay there and continue with the meeting. There was no real credible threat. Had the hotel been, if it was under an attack, if there was a sustained attack from a large number of left-wing thugs from outside, and the hotel was, that was a credible risk that the hotel was actually going to be damaged, then fair enough, we could have understood the hotel staff being as as insistent as they were, but I think that they were, they effectively betrayed their lack of experience, really, in terms of being as insistent as they were. But I don't think that they had met somebody like Peter Rushton before, who was an immovable object as far as this is concerned. You know, he was determined and nothing was going to stop him. And I think probably that was an object lesson to them, in that not everybody is a feeble, wishy-washy snowflake, and that people in the nationalist community in this country are made of sterner stuff. And you know, we don't crumble and shrink away when we're threatened by Antifa, and you know, in fact, the opposite. We're intent on asserting our right to hold our meetings, and will not be chased away. And so hopefully hotels in future, when similar sort of things happen, will get to hear of what happened on that particular afternoon, and will therefore decide to act differently in future. So I think that one of the things that is interesting is that Professor Furison's historical revisionism relates to the Second World War, and whenever the Second World War is mentioned in terms of the way in which the British public behaved during the Blitz, etc., there's always this pride that is put forward through, you know, the message of pride is always conveyed through whatever television program or film or whatever it is, that we British are made of stern stuff, and that during the Second World War we didn't allow the Blitz to to panic us and to make us want to quit and surrender. And yet in the modern day, the way in which people very often behave in circumstances where they're driven by the profit motive and the motive to avoid bother and to avoid any controversy or to avoid any offence, you know, people very often do behave completely differently to that. And I think it was admirable that Professor Furison, that Richard Edmonds and Peter Rushton and Michelle Renouf, that they did embody the spirit that is so often praised that the British used to have in bucket loads, and that some of us still have today.
Well, hotel staff clearly had no backbone. I did hear that the police were called, and the police said, well, unless there is any trouble, unless you actually see something, then we can't come out. And I think the hotel staff were acting illegally. It's not illegal to deny the Holocaust. You can say what you like about the Holocaust. You can say what you like about revisionism. And the fact is that there wasn't anybody out there that was threatening. If there had been somebody out there threatening, then the hotel would have had a duty of care to the paying guests, i.e. Peter Rushton and all the rest of you that were there, to then throw you out. I mean, that seems to me to be against the law. They phoned the police up. The police said, well, if there isn't any trouble, we can't do anything about it. So the police had told them, look, they're not doing anything wrong. The police didn't say, oh, it's Holocaust denial, we better get out there straight away and arrest them. The police didn't say that. They said, well, if the Antifa turn up, tell us, but we can't do anything until then. And if the police are unable to do anything about it, then the hotel are unable to do anything about it, I would suggest. I mean, I would be looking at suing the hotel, to be honest, or making some kind of case against them in the civil court for what they did. Because I don't think that's on to just shut down a meeting because there's been a phone call. And I think it should be highlighted that this phone call, as you said, was very likely to have been made by Hope Not Hate, who seem to think that they are above the law. I don't know if you want to add anything else to your review of this meeting before we move on to some of the news that's been going on in Britain last week, Max. Is there anything else you'd like to add to that?
Well, just that you're quite right that the hotel staff were acting in breach of contract, so in a perfect world it should have been possible for the meeting organisers to sue the hotel for losses as a result of the meeting being disrupted in the way that it was, because they didn't need to disrupt the meeting. But I think in the world in which we live, where in reality, unless you are a member of one of the protected minorities, or unless you've got bottomless pockets as far as the money needed to finance legal actions is concerned, then you don't really have recourse to justice through the courts. And I think that, but what was demonstrated at that meeting was effectively civil disobedience on the part of our staff in, not our staff, our guests, in fact, in refusing to accede to the hotel.
No, I think it was them being disobedient. It was the hotel. I don't think you were being civilly disobedient at all. You imagine if it had been an ethnic minority in that situation who had been discussing something entirely legal, nothing against the law, a group of ethnic minorities that were in that room, and the hotel staff come in and say, there's people outside that are threatening to beat you up and beat us up, so we're going to shut down the meeting and kick you out to the people that are outside. If that had been ethnic minorities, there'd be an absolute uproar. It would be all over the news.
There would, and that's what I say. In a perfect world, then there would have been scope, and the organisers of the meeting could have taken that kind of action against the hotel staff. But we don't live in an ideal world. We live in a world where white people are effectively second class citizens. And when we try to act in our own ethnic interests, the establishment in this country, whether it's the legal establishment, whether it's the police, or whether it's the government, they just do not support our right. Don't support our rights effectively. So we have no rights when we try to act in our own ethnic interests. And as far as this meeting was concerned, had we appealed to the police, or had we later tried to take action to the courts, then we probably would have found that the person appointed to be the judge to hear the case would be somebody from an ethnic minority background, or somebody from with some other common purpose connection or something of that sort, who would just let the court case go on for long enough in order to bleed our pockets dry. And then find in favour of the hotel management. That's the kind of thing that would actually happen. You know, we know that that's the situation that exists. I think it's good that through broadcasts such as we're making now, that we're able to bring it to the attention of a wider public that is the case. But at the moment, I don't think there's a lot that we can do about it. And as far as where I mentioned the word disobedience, I wasn't necessarily saying that we were being bad by being disobedient. I think that where we are requested to do things by either agents of the state, or where by people who are acting in concert with agents of the state, then civil disobedience is a weapon that's open to us, and we did disobey the requests of the hotel staff that we abandon the meeting, and in that respect our civil disobedience was victorious over their desire to shut the meeting down.
Yeah, they trampled all over your civil rights. I don't think you were being disobedient, but at least, I can understand what you're saying there about what would happen if it was taken to court. We know that the courts are anti-white, and we know that lawfare is one of the activities that they are engaged in, particularly in America, bleeding nationalist pockets dry while they're waiting to have court cases. And over here, we've got nationalists that are just wasting away in prison on remand for up to a year at a time before their actual trial has been heard. And that brings me to the next news story here, which is this national action trial that's going on in Birmingham. Now, I covered this a couple of weeks back. I think you may have been here as well, Max, when we did that. And we talked a bit about the introductory talk that the Crown had put forward, the story that the Crown was putting forward, and that was all covered in the newspapers for a week in great detail. They called National Action a violent group that was at war with society, but didn't actually produce any evidence of any violence ever actually occurring. What they did produce evidence of was photographs of people playing dress up. And that was it, basically, playing dress up and holding a baby and a swastika pastry cutter. And then since then, we've heard nothing at all. We've had over a week's gone by and we've heard nothing whatsoever in the newspapers. And the reason for this is because it's now the defence that are actually talking. And there has been one news report, which I managed to locate yesterday on the BBC, which is actually from a week ago. But it talks about the start of the defence. And I think there's some interesting things that we can gain from this. A father on trial accused of being a fanatical neo-Nazi terrorist has admitted being a racist. Adam Thomas, 22, also told the court he gave his baby son the middle name Adolf to reflect his admiration for Hitler. He admitted posing for photographs in Ku Klux Klan robes with his newborn son, but said it was just play. Mr. Thomas, along with partner Claudia Patatas, 38, and Daniel Begonovich, 27, denies being a member of banned far-right group National Action. Giving evidence at Birmingham Crown Court, Mr. Thomas was asked by his barrister, Frida Hussein, "Are you a racist?" "Yes," he replied. He said the chat groups where he had made anti-Semitic and racist remarks to other alleged National Action members were with people who he shared interests with and were not intended for public consumption. So this just shows that absolutely everything that they are throwing at them in this court case is private. It's private behaviour. You've got private chat groups there, not intended for the public, not intended for the public to see and be shocked at and horrified that they're using racist slurs, but people of friends of his. I mean, it's effectively what they're trying to say here is that you're not even allowed to think these things. You're not even allowed to discuss them in private with your friends. I mean, a private chat room is the same as being in your living room, having guests around, and you're talking to them in private, away from where anybody else can see. And that's what's gone on here. They are using remarks that they made to one another in a private chat room. They're using photographs that were absolutely private. They're now reduced to asking him if he's a racist or not. So they're quite clearly just trying to prejudice the jury here. I'm very pleased that you know, he's just standing up and saying, well, no, I do admire Adolf Hitler. That's got nothing to do with National Action. Yes, that was me in a Ku Klux Klan robes. That's got nothing to do with National Action. And it really is quite clear that they're just trying to prejudice this jury here. I mean, the real worry about all this is, the real fly in the ointment is that one of the people that are accused here has pleaded guilty to being a member of National Action. As we know, National Action shut down as soon as it was made illegal. There was a long declaration that was actually made by Ben Raymond about this, saying that there was no way it was going to continue. So we know that National Action doesn't exist, and yet they're still prosecuting these people. And the fact that they've now got somebody who has pled guilty to it, I mean, what that says to me is that the conditions of our prisons are similar to medieval torture sessions now. Apparently, this person that's actually pled guilty, he's got Asperger's, he's also autistic, he's one of those people that swears a lot and is rude to people, basically. There's no way that he should actually be in prison for his own health and safety, because he will be being beaten up all the time. And I would suggest that that's the reason why this guy has pleaded guilty. But it's making it look bad for the rest of them, that one of them has said that he is a member of them. But all of this whole is a real circus that they've got going on here, that they're, you know, just bringing out these photographs of people and accusing them of being racist, as if that's got anything to do with them being members of a prescribed organization. I mean, it's really quite shocking that this is going on, and that nobody is pointing out that this is actually prejudicing the jury here. I mean, do you want to add something to this, Max, before I move on to the next part of this article?
All really, I suppose, that I would say is that, okay, somebody has admitted their guilt, but I think under English law, just a purely an admission of guilt isn't sufficient to actually convict somebody. And so, for example, if somebody had been accused of murder, and they said, yes, I have committed murder, but if there was no body and there was no evidence that somebody had been killed, then the very fact that somebody walks you know, when somebody stands up in front of a court or walks into a police station and says that I've committed murder isn't sufficient to convict them of murder. So as far as the person who said that, yes, they have been a member of National Action is concerned, the very fact they've admitted it doesn't necessarily mean they're guilty. What needs to happen is that the prosecution would need to would need to demonstrate that there was other corroborative evidence that showed that they were a member of National Action. Now, when you consider that the person who was the founder of National Action, Ben Raymond, who a week prior to the proscription of that political party, announced the disbanding of the organisation and instructed all of the members to cease any further activities, that would tend to be evidence that National Action didn't exist anymore from that date onwards. The fact that Chris Lithgow, who has been widely touted as the person who took over the leadership of National Action, the fact that he's been found not guilty of being a member of National Action means that both the person who founded National Action disbanded the party and was no longer a member of the party. The person who was allegedly supposed to be the leader of National Action has also been found not guilty of being a member of the party during the period subsequent to its proscription. And so therefore, how could somebody be a member of an organisation that has got no leader, where there's nobody who's actually been found to have been the leader, where an organisation that has got no kind of organizational infrastructure? So how can you be a member of something that doesn't really that you can't actually prove exists? That's the thing that sort of occurs to me. So from a legal perspective, that's something that needs to be taken into consideration here.
I think Chris Lithgow was actually found guilty. It was Garen Helm that was found not guilty, and there was two others that they couldn't actually decide upon. But I think Chris Lithgow, they did decide that he was guilty. So you're probably getting him mixed up there with Garen Helm. I mean, they're both probably as well known as each other. But I do find it surprising that this guy's actually being defended by a Muslim, Frida Hussain. So, I doubt whether that a Muslim barrister is really going to be doing their best for them here. Continuing with it, the security guard told jurors, that's Mr. Thomas, who is being accused of being a racist, the security guard told jurors he was brought up by his maternal grandparents in Birmingham, but saw his mother, father and stepfather, who he described as common racists, from the age of five. His stepfather, who was in the white power band Screwdriver, which had very racist views, would shave his head. He said his paternal grandfather had a positive view of Hitler and the Nazis and used to deliver a Hitler salute when he visited as a boy. Asked about his child's middle name, he said, "It definitely doubles up as the name of Adolf Hitler. It's undeniable. I don't make a secret of it. It does reflect an interest in that topic and an admiration for what it represents." I would say he's got a solid defence here, because what they are doing is they're used, all those things that they're saying about him, oh, he gives Hitler salutes, oh, he dresses up as the Ku Klux Klan, they're using that to prove that he's part of National Action, when in actual fact, you know, he comes from a family of nationalists. He's one of those very rare people that's actually been brought up by nationalists. He was involved with Screwdriver. He told the court how at school his racist views led to a counter-extremism mentor taking him to see a Holocaust survivor. "Well, she told me she was evacuated from Germany to Britain, and I couldn't see that as being a Holocaust survivor at the time," he said. Mrs. Frieda asked, "Did you tell her to her face?" "I did, yes," he replied. During search of his home, police found KKK robes, which Mr. Thomas admitted belonged to him. Asked about a photograph of him wearing them, cradling his child, he said, "It was just play. They were not put up on some website or used to promote some agenda or ideology." Mr. Thomas and Miss Patatas of Waltham Gardens, Banbury, Oxfordshire, and Mr. Begonovich of Crown Hills Rise, Leicester, deny being a member of the banned group. So they're not really telling us much about this defence here. They're just really trying to make people dislike the guy. But I think he's got a really good solid defence here. And he's saying, look, I've been a nationalist all my life. You cannot say that because I'm a nationalist now, it's because I'm part of national action. And then we've got a final bit here which tells us about this other character that, that's pleaded guilty. The jury were also shown pictures of Thomas posing with Patatas and Darren Fletcher, who has admitted being a member of National Action. Fletcher is seen in images holding a swastika flag and making a Nazi salute. Other images document the couple's collection of far-right memorabilia found at their Oxfordshire home, including swastika cushions and clothing, as well as a swastika-shaped pastry cutter. The couple also allegedly had a poster stuck to their fridge reading, "Britain is ours, the rest must go." Now, I'll just pause here because that was a National Action poster. They did have a National Action poster. "Britain is ours, the rest must go" was a National Action slogan. And if anybody listening here has got flyers that, that have that on there, they really should burn them. Because if you're caught with them, the police could do what they've done to these guys here and say, well, you're a member of National Action. You've still got National Action propaganda. You're still displaying National Action propaganda. You are supporting a terrorist organization by doing that. So if anybody does have any stuff like that that could be linked to National Action, then they really should burn it. I know people want to keep hold of it. It's memorabilia. You know, it might be worth a lot of money in 20 years' time. But just get rid of it, because it's not worth the risk of something like this happening to you. I mean, you look at this. This is a couple with a newborn child, and the father is in prison on remand. And the woman is also in the dock there. They've got all this trouble that's come to them. And this is one thing that does actually link them to National Action, is the fact that they had this picture. But anybody could download that, because the pictures were all available on the internet. And this also reminds me, I mean, Ben Raymond's statement that National Action was shut down, all the websites are gone. So all these, everything that was put up there saying National Action is no more, we're going to try and go the legal route and challenge this because we didn't actually do anything wrong, all of that's been taken down. Because what's happened because of that is the context of a lot of what they did has now gone. Like when they were talking about white jihad and how that was that was a joke, really, because the far right was being compared to the Islamic terrorists. And a lot of what they did was just responding in jokes to things that were going on at the time. But when you take that out of context, it can make it seem as if they're very violent people that wanted to cause lots of trouble, when a lot of the time it was just the ironic jokes. But it's all been taken out of context now, because all the background information has been removed. And this final bit here, Birmingham Crown Court heard that the group carried out a white holy war against black people, Jews, Asians and homosexuals, despite being outlawed. But there's no accusation of any violent acts. There's no evidence of any violent acts. All they've got is a chat room with people joking about ethnic minorities. And yet what they've put here is they were carrying out a white holy war. The prosecution alleged the group tried to shed one skin for another to evade the law, and that the three defendants were part of a successor organisation called the Triple K Mafia. The Triple K Mafia is the Moon Man fan club. And this wasn't any organisation that existed in real life. This is just a private chat room where people told racist jokes. Thomas had stockpiled a cache of weapons, including machetes, crossbows and an axe, well, probably for chopping wood, jurors were told. He is thought to have carried out target practice in his back garden. He certainly didn't carry out target practice against any ethnic minorities, did he? I mean, he's just shooting at a target in his back garden. He is also charged with possessing documents containing terrorist information, namely the Anarchist's Cookbook, which contained bomb-making instructions. Again, that's available in Waterstones. That's available in any bookstore. It's just the fact that it's a nationalist that owns this cookbook. I really hope that the jury can see what's going on with all of this, and that there actually isn't any evidence at all that there are anything to do with National Action. All there is evidence that they've actually done nothing illegal. Maybe some people may find it disgusting that he dresses as a Ku Klux Klan, or that he calls his son Adolf, but that's not illegal. That's not against the law. This is the first time that this, you know, paraphernalia is being used to try and draw a link with terrorism, I guess.
Also, I think the thing that's being missed here is that National Action isn't the only avowedly National Socialist organisation in Britain. And so therefore, having an admiration for the sort of National Socialist period in Germany isn't the same as being a member of National Action. You know, it's like every square is a rectangle, but not every rectangle is a square. And by the same token, the people who were members of National Action were people who, by and large, had respect and admiration for Hitler, but not everybody who had respect and admiration for Hitler was a member of National Action. And so therefore, proving that somebody had respect and admiration for Adolf Hitler doesn't actually prove that they are a member of National Action.
Well, there's a lot like that, isn't there?
That's the logical flaw in what the prosecution are trying to do. You know, what they've got to do is they've got to prove that they were involved in promoting and furthering the aims of National Action during the period National Action has been prescribed, not to prove that there are Me Toos between people who were members of National Action or may have been members of National Action and other people. For example, we're coming up to November the 5th. I'm sure that all over the country at some point during the November the 5th celebrations, people, quite ordinary people, will be going out and buying themselves fireworks, which could be described, if the police wanted to interpret them in that way, as explosive devices. And so the police could raid houses up and down the length and breadth of the country and arresting people for possessing improvised explosives, and they could make the case that all these people were members of a terrorist organization, when in reality all they are is perfectly innocent people celebrating November the 5th, or you know, buying some fireworks in order to celebrate November the 5th. And so I think in the courts of law, it's deplorable that this kind of emotive comparison is being made in a way that's intended to emotionally influence the jury rather than the prosecution putting forward a logical case that is supported by actual evidence.
Well, they did actually do that, didn't they? They went after somebody that had a very tenuous link to National Action, and they went after him, and he had a cardboard tube with some sprinklers in it, and they did go after him for having an explosive device, simply because he was a nationalist. But, you know, National Action did use a lot of generic white nationalist terms and phrases. I mean, we all talk about a race war. There's an ongoing race war. We're being replaced. There's violence against white people. And National Action talked about there being an ongoing race war as well. But it's being portrayed as if they were engaged in it. They wanted to hunt down Negroes and shoot them and all this nonsense. A lot of it's probably taken from Moon Man lyrics, but just the fact, you know, that they talked about these white nationalist talking points, anybody else who talks about them, they're trying to use that to say that they're National Action.
Yeah, I was in my local village hall two or three days ago, and somebody was setting up an archery equipment. It was quite a big hall. You could fire with a long bow along the length of this hall, and they put targets up with netting to protect the rear wall of the building, and they'd got rows and rows of bows there, and these bows were going to be fired by people who were members of the local archery club. I just happened to sort of stumble upon it by accident. It wasn't something I'd actually gone. I didn't actually even attend the archery session. I just wandered past and saw them setting up this archery stuff and stopped just to have a look. But, you know, what we have is all over the country, up the length and breadth of Britain, there are people who have longbows, people that have crossbows, and people that are involved in archery practice, who follow archery as a quite legitimate hobby. And to say that somebody owning a crossbow is evidence of them being part of a terrorist organization is therefore, you know, invalid. To say that somebody who possesses a longbow, that their possession of the longbow is evidence they're a member of a terrorist organization, again, is totally invalid. As I say, what's got to happen is that rather than picking upon things that lots of people outside of National Action could have had an interest in, and saying that all these things are evidence of National Action membership simply because some people within National Action also shared an interest in those things is just logically flawed argument. And what ought to happen is the judges, in my view, that are overseeing these cases ought to be stopping the prosecution and saying, look, you know, this is something that lots of perfectly innocent people do up and down the length and breadth of the country. Now show us something that actually shows that National Action existed and these people were actually trying to further the cause of National Action.
Well, they're really clutching at straws, aren't they? They're just desperate to get white people and say, oh, look, there are some white terrorists as well. We're not just going after the brown ones. It's not just the Muslims that cause terrorism. It's also the dangerous far right. And that's what the point of all this is. And I believe that the judge that's involved in this was the same judge from the other case. I mean, this is why the judge isn't throwing these cases out, because the judge is biased himself. I mean, he's allowing all this prejudicing of the jury to go on, all these irrelevant things such as private family photos from the family album, the fact they have pastry cutters shaped like swastikas. So what? That's got nothing to do with National Action. And the judge hasn't thrown this out. You know, it's the judge that is against them, that is biased against them. It's the government that is biased against them. And when they were banned, they weren't actually banned for carrying out any terrorist acts. They were just banned because of the feelings that Amber Rudd had. She didn't like them because they were Nazis, racists, homophobic, la-di-da-di-da. That was the reason for banning them. And so what they've got, they've got the whole establishment that are against these young nationalists that are just throwing everything they can at them. And, you know, what we've got to hope that the jury that is actually deciding this really is 12 men good and true, and that they actually see through it. I know Jared Taylor has a lot of faith in the justice system in America, and he likes to point out the fact that, I forget the name of the guy, who shot the young black lad, Tyrone. I can't even remember the name of the black guy that he shot, but he shot a black guy in self-defense, and all the Negroes wanted his blood, and he was basically found innocent for doing that. And the same with the copper that shot Michael Brown. He was found innocent. So there are instances when the jury do the right thing. They did the right thing with Garen Helm, and they freed him. Although, what good that's done the guy after he's been in jail for a crime he didn't commit for a year? Is he going to be able to get any compensation for that? I doubt it. The two others that they were unable to decide on, they are still in prison. The government is hoping to try them again. So there is a chance that there are actually decent people on this jury, and they will see through what's going on. And we've just got to have faith in that, I guess. We haven't really got that much longer to go here, Max. Is it too short a time to talk a little bit about Tommy Robinson? I know that you've discovered something about him, some of his connections recently. You're still muted, Max.
Yeah, it's not so much a matter of having discovered something new about Tommy Robinson. It's just more a matter that there's been a bit of publicity surrounding him, the possibility of him going over to America on a speaking tour. And the newspaper article I saw mentioned that there were two organizations that were going to be paying for him to go over there, and from which he is expected to receive substantial fees, one of them being an organization called the Middle East Forum and the other one being called the David Horowitz Freedom Center. And it's just struck me that it's interesting that a lot of people criticize Tommy Robinson for being overtly Zionist and that use the fact that Tommy Robinson is overtly Zionist as a basis to criticise his campaign and to portray him as stooge or somebody who's leading nationalism along the wrong path, but he doesn't seem to, if these stories are true and that he is going to be going and speaking to these two organizations, he doesn't seem to be doing his case any good by doing that, by virtue of the fact that the two organizations concerned are staunchly Zionist organizations, and where the founders and the prime movers within these organizations are people who are Zionist Jews. And so it's I think the conundrum that most people wrestle with regard to Tommy Robinson is the question of whether he is somebody who is effectively turning a blind eye to the harmful effects of Zionism and doing what people euphemistically describe as riding the tiger in order to benefit from Zionist influence within the media as a means of boosting his own notoriety and his own influence politically, so that he can at least do some good, or whether he is perhaps a stooge of Zionism who is leading nationalism down the sort of blind alley of Islamophobia and pro-Zionism. That's really the question that this opens up in my mind.
Well, he's never hidden his support for Zionism. He never has hidden that. So you can't really call him a shill. He's not covering for it. He's always been quite open about it. I do think he's genuine. I think he genuinely thinks that the Jews have been good for Britain. I think he genuinely thinks that the Jews are against the Muslims, because he looks over at Israel and what's happening there with all the Muslims attacking them. And what concerns me is, I mean, I can't see him ever getting out of that, especially not now, because when he was at his lowest point in Gallup's Ezra Levant to the rescue, while he was in prison in solitary, it was Ezra Levant that collected all the money for him. It was Ezra Levant that sorted all the lawyers out for him. And, I really cannot stand Ezra Levant. But Tommy Robinson is now looks to him as if he's part of his family, because he's done so much good for him. And that really will steer things in the opposite direction to which we really want them to go. But at least he is still highlighting the grooming gangs. He's highlighting the problems with Islam, the problems with immigration. Apparently he's actually going over to America to speak to Congress. So with all these things, I just look at it like a spectrum. There's people that are, at one end of the spectrum, and then there's people that are at the other. And Tommy Robinson is it right at the other end of the spectrum to us, but he is still on the same spectrum as us. You know, he is still called far right. He is still exposing grooming gangs. He's still exposing Islamic crimes. He's still exposing, the ludicrous hate speech laws. So as far as I'm concerned, he's on the same side as us. But at the same time, it is concerning the amount that he does have to do with these Jews. I mean, maybe one day he will realise just how much of the problems that Tommy Robinson is actually concerned with have actually been brought about by the Jews. I mean, he seems to be a little bit short-sighted. He doesn't really sort of look back any further than the last 30 years. Amory Waters, she's pretty good. But she still only goes back as far as 70 years. I mean, she has a 70-year cutoff point. She won't look beyond the end of the Second World War. If she did, she would realise that actually the National Socialists were the good guys during that war. But it seems that's as far as they will go, and possibly that is because they do get backing from these Jews. And obviously, if they're getting backing from Jews, these Jews will say to them, don't criticise Israel. Don't show support for the National Socialists. Call your enemies fascists. And if you continue to do that, you'll continue to get the money from us. And I dare say they look at it and they say, well, if we don't have the money from these guys, we won't get the publicity that we need. So we just have to take it. I'm certain that some of them are like that. I know that some of them do know the truth, but they don't talk about it. And it's got to be because they get funding from Jews like Ezra Levant, like these organisations that you just listed there, Max. But I am thankful that we have him, and I am thankful that we do finally have a movement in Britain. Now, I do think he gave a wonderful speech outside court the other day where he was attacking the media. I think that was great. At least we do have someone to rally around, and Gerard Batten is saying some good things as well. It's just, we really need someone who's actually going to speak up for our ethnicity and completely racialize politics. That's what we need.
It's the ideological coherence that's missing with people like with Tommy Robinson, and also on a much larger scale with people like Donald Trump. You know, Donald Trump, people argue about whether Donald Trump is, you know, really one of us, or whether Donald Trump has really got the interests of the American people at heart, or whether, you know, he's too much under the influence of Israel and Zionism. But in reality, Donald Trump for the political establishment is a massive spanner that's been thrown in the works. You know, what he says isn't necessarily ideologically coherent. He tends to speak in a way which is comes from the gut rather than from his head. And I think that Tommy Robinson is a very similar person, and that they both seem to have this knack of motivating lots of people and of winning support and of gaining publicity. It's just, I suppose, a frustration for lots of people that the ideological coherence isn't there, and so that you can look upon what they're doing with a certain amount of support and have a considerable degree of goodwill towards them, but without being able to be sort of wholly. Wholly supportive of them, just because of this sort of ideological flaw in the way in which they put their arguments forward.
Yeah, I think it's very similar to with Donald Trump. He's a super Jew lover, but at the same time, he says things like, "I am a nationalist, not a globalist," which totally riles the left up. I mean, so many things Donald Trump has done which are absolutely fantastic, and Tommy Robinson is in the same mold. You know, he has done a lot of good. He has galvanized nationalists in Britain. And, I for one am pleased that we have him, even though I disagree with him on many subjects. And he would probably say, "I am totally against national socialists like Sven Longshanks," but I still support him anyway. All right, Max, thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Aryan Britannia for you. Don't forget, we do require donations to keep the website going, and we do have a Bitcoin wallet at the bottom of every article. Thank you very much for listening, and I do hope you all have a great week ahead of you.
To the anti-white system on RadioArean.com.